This is Mike Foster from People of a Second Chance. I'm here with Charles Lee. We're here at the Catalyst West Conference. And Charles, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Yeah, so you have a lot going on in your life these days.
A little bit.
Yeah, what I love about you, Charles, is that you're always going for figuring out new ways to engage people and different. And one of the things I love about kind of your approach is that it's very collaborative and you love to do things in partnership. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, of late I've been thinking a lot more about collaboration, and I have this talk that's called Collaboration, but with an emphasis on the labor part. I think we live in such a quote-unquote connected age that can trick our minds into thinking that we're actually working together. So you can have collaboration at a thought level when you retweet somebody or, you know, you share a link. I mean, those things are really good and needed. But if you really want to get stuff done, you have to, you know, clarify, you know, the objectives for the relationship, figure out what is it that we're actually going to do together, and then start, you know, putting it down on paper, even contractually, if need be.
Yeah, because a lot of times I think we would prefer sort of these loose partnerships, or just, you know, I'll retweet something and that will show that I'm in or helping. Right. But you're really calling for something much deeper and much more collaborative.
Right. And it's very complex. I mean, when you have just two human beings who are complex on their own respective rights come together to try to work towards something, I mean, managing expectations, one person can be entering the quote-unquote collaboration, thinking that it's just a personal level of collaboration, while the other one's thinking organizationally. And so one will obviously become more disappointed than the other, because it wasn't said clear. I mean, we're using words like, hey, let's connect, let's network, let's collaborate. And those have multiple layers and multiple kinds of collaboration, multiple levels of collaboration. So I think it's sometimes unrealistic for people to think, hey, I'm just going to connect with you. And the reality is most people don't. So it takes intentional work and effort.
So you obviously have been studying this, researching it, living it out in your own life. What are some of the top things needed for good collaboration?
I think people have to make sure that they don't shy away from a formal agreement. I know companies do this, and I know, Mike, you do this in your company all the time, but I think even among organizations or networks, even if it's not a full-blown 60-page NDA or anything like that, even if you did a one-pager to say, here's what I'm bringing to the table, if I understand correctly, here's what we're going to try to do. Here's our objective for at least, you can always have a friendship, but if it's really going to be about working together on projects, we could write it down on a one-page quick sheet and say, hey, here's what I think we're talking about, and allow the other party to kind of refine. So even if things change in the future, you actually have a point of reference.
That's so good, because I think a lot of times, just being Christians, we think, well, of course, we're all on the same page. Right. We all agree on these things. Or we give each other the benefit of the doubt. But really, writing it down actually helps when things go south, or what could possibly go wrong. And listen, things go wrong in partnerships and collaborations, right?
Yeah, most definitely. And the flip side also is, it also gives you a point of reference of celebration.
Yes.
Saying that we actually got this done. And probably looking back, you might even say, we did so much more than we set out to do. And the flip side, like you mentioned, is really important, is that, you know, you can go back to that document or whatever and say, you know, that's not what we agreed to. So it's helpful. And when the person recognizes that your goal is to actually get it done, I think they're going to be less defensive to actually get it down on paper.
Yeah, it sometimes feels we have sort of this misconception that if we were to write out the agreement together, that it's sort of like a prenup in a marriage, and it's kind of like, yeah, you know, it kind of some ugly feelings around that. But really, to me, it's an honorable thing to do,
right,
and necessary, and actually produces good results.
Right. And that's the heart. I think, you know, going all the way back now, unlike the Old Testament, we're not going to take animals and split them in half and, you know, develop covenants that way. Or maybe we should. I don't know.
That would definitely show that you're serious about what you're doing.
But even back in ancient times, even literally, I've done some ancient Near East studies, and even a handshake was a sign of covenant making. You know, sharing a meal was a sign of covenant making. So there are all these layers of formality that I think we should start re-embracing again, is to say, hey, let's do this. Let's not, you know, I don't want to go to another meeting where there's potential of collaboration that never comes to pass. And it's like, all of us are pretty busy. So I tend to gravitate towards people that have some kind of plan, or, you know, at least some access to mutual planning. And then we usually get stuff done.
Yeah. So tell me, a lot of people listening right now probably are involved in some type of work that involves convincing people that their idea is a good idea, whether it's their church and the gospel message, or maybe some social justice work. How do you take people who are maybe supportive or overly receptive to your idea, but how do you actually turn them into an active participant and really have that credible action piece happen?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think maybe it goes back to actually having a plan that's more specific than a general vision. So, for example, like I'll use a local church ministry example. Years ago when I was doing youth ministry, I would make these announcements at church like, hey, help us with the youth group. And, you know, if you're interested, come see me after church. And reality is very few people responded. And from hindsight, I'm thinking, you know, probably many of them who heard the announcement thought, oh, man, I got to do all-nighters. I can't, you know, I can't handle that anymore. My youth pastor was great, but there's no way I can live up to that, you know, level. Or people have all of these, their own filter through which they hear things. But once I kind of shifted gears and said, okay, if you want to help out the youth group, if you have an hour, here are five things you can do. If you have 2 hours, suddenly it became a little bit more crystal clear on how they can connect. And I think that's true for organizations. I meet a lot of young social entrepreneurs, both nonprofit and for-profit, and they have this great vision. Then I ask them, so how does someone get involved? Then there's usually like silence. Like they just, there's so much about the cause, if you will, or the overall vision that they're not creating enough pathways for people to engage them.
Yeah, I know personally I've been guilty of that many times. It's like all idea, all concept, all vision, and yet people are going, all right, I love it. What do I do now?
Right.
And you really have to answer that question for people. So let me ask you, maybe it's people listening right now who love ideation and love the, you know, coming up with new ideas and really wanting to be creative, yet maybe are running a little dry or feeling a little stale in their creativity, or just, you know, you go into those seasons where you just, you're like, I can't even think straight, let alone come up with a good idea. What are some of maybe the practices that you do, or what are some things that you would suggest to help people, you know, become more creative?
Right. I think one of the things that I do personally is I give ideas a break. And you know, going in, I know that I only have one portion of the idea that will ultimately work. And I know it's in the friendships, in the networks that I'm a part of, where the remainder of the idea will actually form. So I go in thinking I don't have all of the idea. And I also know that often creativity happens when you're in spaces that are unfamiliar to you. So what I'll do is sometimes start reading books, for example, unrelated to my field. So this sounds sick, I know, but one summer I read through an Algebra 2 book.
That does sound sick. I'm just being honest with you, Charles.
Because I knew reading through that, it would just once again refine my logical skills. And I know it doesn't necessarily have a direct impact on the creative industries that I work in. But I knew that it would spark something. Or maybe even going to an actual conference that's not in your field, or if you're somewhere where you have to be anyway, attend some workshops that are out of the scope of your interest. And it's kind of like the whole Medici effect. When you start sparking what seems to be unrelated conversations, they start connecting. And I think that's why, like in places like Europe over the centuries, pubs have been so powerful, because you had so many people from so many different professional backgrounds that got together all around ideas.
So in the idea process, as we're thinking about ideation and being creative and getting maybe in some spaces that help us do that better. Are all ideas good ideas?
No, all ideas are not good ideas. All ideas are ideas, and they have the potential of being good. But the reality is whatever idea you start with is probably not great yet. I think that would be impossible where you just figure out all the details instantaneously. So that gives me hope is that any idea can become probably a great idea if the right pieces.
Tell us, how does a average idea or a possibly leaning towards a good idea become a great idea?
And some of the things I always encourage people to do is one is you have to write it down or type it in. I'm sure you get pitches left and right of ideas, Mike. And there's something about writing it down that allows you to process where once again, you have a point of reference in conversation. Because I know recent studies have shown that if you have an idea and you just start sharing it, it tricks your brain into thinking you're actually doing something about it. Mm-hmm. So if you can prematurely share an idea. But once you have it kind of written down, you can then start sharing it and then allow people into your own space to kind of develop it a little bit better. So, to do that and then be honest. I mean, some ideas are meant to be, it's a good idea. But nowadays, like Seth Godin always says, like, good is boring. Mm-hmm. You have to be great or remarkable. So if you have something, it may be not mainly, it may end up being not so much the main idea, but it may be a good way to handle a subsection of a greater vision. Hmm. So I think part of it is like categorizing, like this would be a great idea to do something that supports a greater idea.
Yes.
Right? So not every idea is that one big great idea.
Yes. And knowing the difference is right. Really important. I think too, sometimes, and this is what I love about kind of your approach, Charles, is this collaborative piece is sometimes we feel like we have to fully bake the idea by ourselves before we release it. We have to get that average idea to a great idea before it actually can be start to share with others. Right. I know I've been guilty of that myself. What do you think about this, the idea of maybe launching good ideas and letting them grow and mature and even like publicly put them out there.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that's a great approach, because the idea you start with will rarely be the idea you end with. Mm. So there's always an evolution, there's always refinement. And that refinement often takes place in community, which I think is really healthy. You need some accountability. So when I was talking about prematurely sharing it, it needs to be somewhat baked, mm-hmm. even if it's half baked,
yes.
so that people have something to actually refine. I think there's definitely, I always say like wisdom comes in motion. So yes. Most idea makers won't even know which questions to ask, most of them, until they're already in process. And I think that's where people get stuck is because they're like, I need to know all the answers to this. When actually, they don't even know the questions to it yet, unless they start.
Yeah,
and I don't know if that's been true for your experience.
Very true. I mean, I'm in the middle of it right now with people with Second Chance. We launched with just a mm-hmm. very simple, unbaked idea, and it's taken almost a year for us to figure out what it is.
Right.
But that didn't stop us from publicly talking about it and building it and creating and inviting people into it.
Right.
And I think sometimes we feel like, this isn't good enough, or I don't want to. It's not ready yet. And it just sits there for years sometimes, and it never gets done.
Yep.
So that idea of experimentation is a good part of ideation. Now, tell me, you have transitioned recently to focus on this work of helping for-profits and nonprofits be better at these ideas that we're talking about. You're a pastor at a church.
Right.
In fact, I spoke at your church, which was an amazing experience. Love that. Tell me about that transition and kind of what God's been leading you to.
Yeah, I think over the last 5 years, I've really shifted my understanding of the church as it relates to kingdom activity. And I actually went through counseling for about a year to try to figure this out, because all my life I kind of heard, while in more like biblical training, if you will, that the pinnacle of serving God is being a lead pastor.
Yes.
Not that all my professors thought that, but that's kind of the implied communication that happens. And so I went through counseling, and my counselor picked something up well. And she was saying, basically, the only thing I've had in common throughout my entire life was entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. You know, I was raised in a family of entrepreneurs, and they started several businesses. Everything related to ministry was about startups, church plants, restarts, denominational work, and so forth. And through those times, I realized I kind of picked up a little bit of, I don't know how much of his inherent gifting, but just kind of knack for figuring stuff out. And in grad school, I studied philosophy. So just that critical thinking process has actually come back to really help. And then when I kind of put those two worlds together to acknowledge my life pattern for the first 30 some years and to recognize that it can still honor God in the midst of his work, that if I could sit with an organization or even a church on and off, we work more with companies and organizations, but every so often we'll get to work with a church or a Christian organization even, to know that we can help them exponentially do better for greater like kingdom impact. That's what fuels our company is. We really only want clients that have some component of good, whether they know they are or not, quote unquote, supporting the advancement of his kingdom, is that if I can help them just do better and make our planet a better place, I feel like at the end of the day, you know, God will be pleased by that.
So if people want to get in contact with you, Charles, give us sort of, you know, website, all that fun stuff.
Yeah, I think my hub for all of my different activities is just my own personal website. So it's just Charles, the letter T, Lee, L-E-E.com.
Excellent. Charles, thanks for sharing with us today. We appreciate your incredible insights on creativity and ideation, and all the best to you.
Thanks, Mike.